Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Nettleman, Carlyle's Global Head of Distribution, for a discussion about trends we're hearing from limited partners and investors. This episode was recorded on March 22nd, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. So let me just start with some background on what we're seeing in our global portfolio. And last month, we really tried to contextualize some of the numbers, spent some time talking about the attitudinal changes we've observed at management teams since the onset of the pandemic, really as it relates to inflation. And first and most obviously was that 2021-22 period where for the first time in really 20 years, in many cases, the first time in many people's career, you had management teams that were really willing to push on price, to be more aggressive about pricing. And that required first, I think, overcoming this fear of losing market share. You know, that the sense that many people had that inhibited some more aggressiveness on pricing in the past, that there was this shadow supply out there just waiting to separate you from your customers whenever you tried to increase prices. And the fact that those price increases stuck, the fact that they worked, I think, again, created a sense of confidence about the ability to continue to push in the future when conditions warranted. And I think that in some cases, we also, of course, saw some businesses, depending on sector, that also recognized that in some cases, they could move to what was in some ways a higher price, lower output model in terms of maximizing profitability earnings. And, you know, these changes, very dramatic, again, relative to attitudes prior to the pandemic, where everything was about productivity growth, efficiency gains, keeping prices low, really just focused on market share. And I think that we continue to see the effects of these attitudinal changes in the data. No matter where you look, inflation data, price data have really continued to surprise to the upside. And I think that one point we made entering the year was that so much of the decline in inflation in the second half of 2023 was attributable to very aggressive discounting for goods producers. And this was, we saw a very sizable increase in inventory to sales ratios, this unwanted increase in inventories, again, largely tied to people, instead of buying stuff, going out to movies, going to concerts, live events, travel, other tourism spending. But by the end of 2023, those inventory to sales ratios, after that period of aggressive discounting to get rid of those unwanted inventories, had largely returned to pre-pandemic averages. And so, as we've seen through the first 3 months of the year, goods prices are no longer falling. They're actually rising modestly, certainly, but they're no longer falling. So, you know, when you look at autos, furniture, apparel, those sorts of things, again, goods that people purchased, large share of the decline in inflation in 2023 now really making no longer any contribution to pulling inflation down. And at the same time, we continue to see services inflation that is relatively elevated. That's most obvious, of course, when looking at auto and homeowners insurance in the first couple of months of the year. So really, when you put this together, when the Fed met in December, the meeting where they really openly suggested that rate cuts had finally come into view, the data available to them as they arrived at that meeting suggested that the current rate of disinflation would put inflation back at the Fed's target by June of 2024. So no surprise, given that rate of disinflation, they were starting to ready the markets and broader economy for rate cuts. Since that time, the rate of disinflation has more than halved. And as a consequence, based on current trends, price stability, again defined as that 2% core PCE target, will not arrive until the middle of 2025. So a big change. The Fed did acknowledge that with the summary of economic projections, where it marked up expected year-end core inflation to 2.6%, up by 0.2% from the last meeting. But overall, when we look at the economy and look at where we sit today, I think first, the real data continue to be reasonably strong. Overall portfolio data are consistent with the GDP growth in roughly a 2% range. Again, I think much of this can be attributed to fixed rate mortgages. By having these mortgage rates locked in, US households, about 40% of households that own their home with mortgages against it, are saving about $530 billion annually relative to if these were floating rate. And that accounts for almost 3% of personal consumption expenditure. So, you know, when you're insulated from rate hikes, it means that your spending can grow at roughly the same rate as a growth in compensation, which continues to be in excess of 4%. Secondly, again, we think about where we sit, inflation continues to be above target, no signs of it really going back up in a generalized way, but again, it's not really falling either. And then third, when you think about the checklist that a central bank might have, real growth, prices, and then third, financial conditions. And here things really do look pretty hot. You've seen very large declines in measures of implied volatility, the VIX index, but also credit spreads. And it's not just that credit spreads have tightened considerably, it's that they're tightening with record issuance volumes, at least through the first 10 weeks of the year. Refinancing businesses, ability to finance new businesses, really, I think it looks more like 2021, certainly than anything we've seen in the last 2 years. So just to summarize, you know, I think when we look at the portfolio and look at the financial markets in which we operate, it's kind of remarkable that the Fed is talking about rate cuts. You know, if you just looked at things where they sit today, it wouldn't immediately occur to you that rate cuts or a bias towards cutting rates is the appropriate stance for policy. And I think the message from that is that this is a central bank that really does want to cut. And I still think we should expect at least 2 cuts at some point over the course of the year. And the big question in the months ahead will just be whether the data cooperate with that very evident desire on the part of policymakers who continue to talk about rate cuts, despite, again, I think broad metrics suggesting that that is perhaps inapt for the current moment. So with that, I'm very happy to be joined by Jeff. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
And hey, Jason, on your commentary, though, can I ask you?
Please.
So you're an erudite, smart guy, and we were just talking about music. I'm going to give you the song that I think that goes along with the Fed's behavior is Journey's Don't Stop Believing. And so, because we were talking about Elton John, what song pops into your head on the Fed's behavior? And I'm asking you this on the spot, so it's a little challenging.
Sure. No, I just think it's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me.
Yeah, it is pretty extraordinary where we are. I know everybody likes to talk about Goldilocks, but there's an okay chance we may get to Goldilocks. And then when you talked about where vols realize and across asset classes, again, we're in this period where everything seems so safe. It's all safe with realized vols. Congratulations on being right over the last couple of years, because I've noticed that as well. We are in an interesting position. And oddly, I run pretty bullish personally. Pretty bullish about where the next year shakes out, but it is an interesting time. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No. One thing that does make me bullish, in addition to just the data still being very strong, and also in areas that do look where spending or investment is likely to be more sustained, is that I do think conditional risk in the market has come off quite considerably, because the Fed can ease massively if something goes wrong in the real economy. Core inflation today is 2.8%. That's a long way from 6 or 7%, where the Fed really, at that point, if the economy went into recession, they have to be much less aggressive, move to accommodation at a much slower pace because of the fear that you can actually get those elevated inflation expectations entrenched and then have a really much bigger, more protracted problem on your hands. Today, if you're entering markets, you do feel like that Fed put.
Well, hold on. I'm going to steal. I like stealing your facts when I hear them from you. If you had told me we were going to go to zero, to a 5.3 or 5.4 base rate, and the odds of that were 1 in a million. That's pretty short odds, and it was 1 in a million. So to your point, the aggressiveness of which the Fed could cut back to a very low base rate, that gives them a lot of leverage in the marketplace, a lot of leverage.
Absolutely. So I do think that some of this decline in volatility is understandable. It is that conditional on things going wrong, what can the Fed do? The answer is quite a lot today, or at least quite a lot relative to what the Fed could have realistically be expected to do a year ago.
Yeah.
When inflation was still a big problem. So you've been here now for almost 6 months. My first question is really just, you can take it the same way you'd like, but what are your impressions of the firm? What are your impressions of Carlyle?
Yeah, Jason, thanks for having me on. You know, I spent almost 30 years in an investment bank and then 4 or 5 years in private equity as an investor, some PE, some credit. I had very high expectations coming in. 30 years ago, when I started at Goldman, or in, I guess 1992, I knew the Carlyle brand. I knew what it meant. I knew the prestige. I'd worked for many years. I'd worked with a lot of the people. So I came in with very high expectations. And I guess I would say on the quality of the culture, the quality of the IQ or candle power, but as importantly, the desire to deliver, as I call it, alpha across the product set to our partners and our LPs is very high and very front and center. And I kind of knew that was going to be the case, but it is really the core of the culture. And then, you know, I would never compare Goldman Sachs culture to anyone else's culture. This is also a very warm, embracing, team-like group of people who want to win. They want to win for clients. They want to win for the firm. So again, it's surpassed my expectations. People have embraced me. You and I have run across each other all over the world together to see folks. We can talk about what clients say to us, but it's been great and surpassed my expectations. But it's been the performance-driven, warm culture I expected, but even better.
I do want to ask, you have, of course, been on the road quite a lot, meeting with clients, with limited partners, with our key relationships. And what are they saying to you right
now?
Both in terms of their expectations, their own portfolios, you know, what they're looking for. What have those conversations been like?
So it'd be fun to do this with you because you and I were in Japan, then I went to China. But before that, I was in Singapore, the Middle East, California, and then I had a chance to go to Asia. You can talk about product, macro, and micro. I think with credit trading where it is, people are very, very focused, call it on the junior part of the capital structure, opportunistic credit, where they can earn, you know, 13 to 17%. And even some spots where you can take 1L risk at, you know, 12-ish percent. I think you and I heard the same things on the excitement in Japan when we were there on what's happening. And you and I could go back many years to talk about the exuberance in Japan that never really materialized and what's happening now. And I think people are extremely focused on Japan, focused on India. And I think, you know, no matter where you go, people are really thinking through how they invest in infrastructure writ large. What does that mean? It means what could the energy transition mean? What data center investing means? But I think some of the things that are happening in infrastructure are quite interesting on the asset basis, the returns. And there's broad interest across micro, macro. And then on Carlyle, I think there's a sense when you and I talk to investors, they would like to figure out how they can do more with us in the best of our product suite that fits, you know, what they're doing. And I always say, you know, we want to be a solution provider. So with their lens, there's plenty of interesting things we're doing globally, but it's been exciting going around the world. And I think even, you know, I had the chance to be in China, and it's not like people are running to put on risk in China, but you do have to think through what the next couple of years looks like in China, given the valuations, direct foreign investment, and what a Donald Trump or a Joe Biden could or could not do. So a lot of exciting things.
That's great. Now, you hear this, you're interacting with, I'm sure you learn quite a lot from in terms of, you know, where portfolios are going, what interests people, where allocations are headed. From your own perspective, just as you look at the world, what most excites you about the current investment opportunity set? The world never ceases being complicated.
Yes.
No matter how bullish or bearish you may feel at a given point, there's still a lot of complexity one has to weigh, whichever way you're hedged or whichever way you're leaning.
Yeah, I have some gray hair on you, but I'll never forget, I was in business school in 1990 or 1991, and I was working on a model. I was terrible. Oh, sorry. I was an investment banking associate for a summer in New York City, and I was doing a DCF, and I asked what discount rate to use, and they said use 17%. Okay. So that was 1990. And then you and I have lived through effectively this regime of rates going to zero. I never really thought I could take good credit risk at, you know, 15 to 17%. That to me is, you know, and I don't just mean direct lending. I mean, prefs, converts, opportunistic, that stuff really, really does interest me. Hey, you know, look, I think some of the investments in the secondary space are about as sweet as it's gotten since I've been looking at it. When I think of, you know, LPs where we can be solution providers for liquidity and where that plays out, sorry, GPs or LPs and where that plays out for investors. So I do think credit and secondaries, and again, this is my menu. This isn't the menu yeah. for everybody. Those are really compelling opportunities.
Yeah, no. I think as you think about, you mentioned junior capital or prefs, it is just this 30%, 50%, 60% of the capital structure as this loss-bearing layer below you. You know, that's the thing that I think is quite remarkable when you talk about the return expectations with that much downside protection. It is quite remarkable. I mean, we're 5 years removed from $16 trillion of sovereign bonds at the various top of the capital stack in the economy more broadly at negative yields.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, it's.
Hey, but let me, you know, on this, because we sound so bullish. Let me flip it to you. When you think about, you're sitting in DC and yeah. you're thinking about the things to worry about for an investor, give me your like top three worries for the coming year. When you sit back and think through some of the potholes, what makes you worried?
Sure. I mean, the first thing is very mundane. And it's just that entering the year, it seemed that a lot of the enthusiasm was predicated on rate cuts that I just didn't suspect were going to happen. And the reason for that is, as we talked about at the time, is that when the economy is growing, when unemployment is relatively low, when things, you know, otherwise look pretty good, the Fed sometimes cuts rates, but it's in a fine-tuning manner, which is to say that one to two, maybe three cuts, but in a very cautious way, trying not to overdo it, waiting for incoming data. At that time, futures markets had priced in seven cuts.
Yeah.
So I thought that the first sort of hiccup or, you know, market reversal might just be when it dawned on people that having a relatively strong economy and massive rate cuts is a confluence of factors that doesn't typically arrive. But the market has largely shrugged this off.
How about up 10% shrug on S&P 500? I mean, that's
Yeah, so the futures markets, as with rates, down to about three now. And so fixed income has repriced, but without any knock-on effects, again, as you point out, in equity markets. So now what happens if the most recent readings in inflation do not just suggest that the annual rate of inflation is no longer falling, but actually starts to tick back up? Because again, the Fed has not at all pivoted from December. It's just the rate cuts are coming. It's just perhaps a few months further into the future than we originally thought. But at some point, that message from the Fed could change materially. I don't expect that, but that's something that, again, I think we should keep an eye on. Secondly, I emphasize again and again, the complexity today, the core complexity is this intersection of energy transition, industrial transformation, and geopolitical rivalry. And I think making sense of this and what it means for policy and what it means for the broader investment environment is extremely hard. So you have, on the one hand, wanting to get to net zero as fast as possible, but also wanting to protect domestic industries, very many of whom are, of course, configured for fossil fuels, whether natural gas is a feedstock or natural gas for high heat, and of course, the auto sector. So allow time and space for that domestic industry to transform itself for this new era of energy. But then at the same time, there's geopolitical tensions where now people look at carbon emissions on a cross-border basis, looking at trade balances in green industry items like EVs, like solar modules, and then start to erect trade barriers, tariffs, to try to square that circle. Again, protecting the domestic industry, not allowing other economies to get a leg up. And I think that to expect all of this to go according to plan, when in fact it doesn't seem that there is a plan, it's just complex competing interests, is another area where I think people have to remain focused and appreciative of
what's going on. Hey, on that, I think two things. I think that's, as you said, very messy and lots of opportunity to think through where you can make money from all those different things, because that is as messy and interesting as it's going to be for the next long while.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation, Jeff, and thank you for joining me and sharing your insights.
Jason, great to hang out. Thanks, man.
On behalf of the team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.